afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of January 11th, 2015. I'm your host, Kurt Franklin, and welcome to this, our first episode of Information Week Live for 2015. We are looking forward to another great year of Information Week Live. We're debuting a new format today that I think is going to be even better and more exciting for everyone. So we're glad you're here. Want to remind everyone that if you are listening to us live, we have not only the audio portion of Information Week Live, but an active online discussion. Now, we hope that you're here and will take part in that discussion, because if you don't, well, you're just missing a big piece of what makes Information Week Live so special. So if you're listening to this live, feel free to jump in, introduce yourself, and be part of the Information Week Live community. Well, we've got a full show today. So to get us started, we have our first guest, Sue Fogarty, who is the chief editor over at our sister site, Network Computing. Sue, welcome to Information Week Live.
Hi, Kurt. Thanks for having me today.
Well, Sue, first of all, you know, remind our listeners here at Information Week Live what network computing is all about.
So network computing is the infrastructure section of Information Week, technically, and we cover everything on the infrastructure part of IT, from networking, storage, cloud infrastructure, which would be mostly private cloud. We cover some UC, also wireless infrastructure, and those kinds of things.
Well, it is certainly an area that is seeing a lot of change and development these days. Tell us what's going on at Network Computing. What kind of big stories are you all talking about over there here at the beginning of 2015?
Well, you know, being infrastructure, it's a little bit slower to get off the ground than the rest of the IT community. You know, they kick right off with CES, and we're a little more slow. We're starting to really wait for things to get cooking, but next week we're looking towards some big announcements in the SDN arena, and SDN is really our big hot topic. It was last year. We expect it to be in 2015 also. SDN and all kinds of virtualization, software-defined, you name it, is really the big thing. This week we published a story about Cisco ACI versus VMware NSX, which are the two big platforms that are vying for attention. And I'm sorry, that's my dog in the background. One of our contributors, I thought he put it very well. He published a blog on his own site that talked about SDN as network programmability blending into the virtualization hairball. So I thought that was just like a great way to portray it. But the story that we posted, when you want to talk about, you know, trying out new formats and being kind of exciting, we actually allowed someone from Cisco who works in the marketing department, but didn't used to work in the marketing department. His name's Joe Onasek, and he is an engineer who is involved in actually developing ACI, which is their SDN platform, and he worked in the NCM business unit, which was a spin-in that Cisco developed to create their platform. He came to us and said, "Can I write this article about Cisco versus VMware's approaches?" And, you know, we kind of went, "Oh, well, we're not really sure if that's a good thing to do editorially." But in the end, we published it because we're finding that SDN is just so complicated, and there's so much vague information out there that users really can't find the detail that they need. And the only people who really have this really exhaustive knowledge about it are the people who actually developed the software and are working with these products, and there aren't enough people out there to answer these questions. So, so far we haven't seen a huge amount of response on the site from this, but we're hoping to give a platform to some of these people so that our readers in the community can come in and ask the right questions and have access to those people and be able to create a place where they can have discussion in an open, you know, objective place.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I know that SDN is a huge deal at the conference that our company puts on called Interop. We're doing Interop Radio, and we had two episodes in late 2014 that were about trying to help people understand what the terms were in SDN and sort of how everything went together. It's one of those things that has been building. I've been very impressed watching the audience numbers build as people look for SDN stuff and find that. This does seem like one of those topics that is going to be huge for some time to come, because as you say, I love that term, the virtualization hairball. That really is how a lot of people see it, because in many ways, it seems like when we talk about virtualization and networking, it's not exactly the same as what we mean when we talk about server virtualization. There are some nuances there that tend to trip people up. Is that something that you're seeing in your community over there?
Yes, you're right. It's not at all. You can't take the same processes and tools and apply them to networking at all. And there are a lot of people working on new tools and new automation structures to be able to do that. But what you said really resonates with me, because I found that, you know, I came into this thinking, oh, well, you know, SDN, I've covered technology all this time. I can learn about this, no problem. And the more I learn about it, the more I find that I don't really know as much as I thought, and that it's way more complicated than I think. And, you know, it's like pulling more strings out of the ball of yarn. It's very, very complex, and it's one of those things that is it really takes very, very, very intricate knowledge of so many different systems, and it's a huge ecosystem of things working together. And it's not just networking, it's not just virtualization, it's not just servers, it's all of these different things that play off of each other. And it's everything kind of coming together that makes the huge difference.
Well, with everything coming together, you mentioned that you're going to be covering some of this in the coming week. Are there anything in particular we should be looking for over at Network Computing in the week ahead?
Well, we will be covering the VMware announcement that's coming up next week. That is mostly on cloud, I think. We will also be covering, not SDN related, but we'll be doing a comparison of wireless access points. And I'm also going to be writing a story about GNS3, which you may remember is a online network emulation platform, and they are integrating some really neat new tools for self-training and community access, with so that you can talk to your fellow emulators and training cohorts. And so I think that'll be a really good community resource for people to learn about.
Well, we will look forward to that and look forward to taking part in the discussion there in the network computing community. Sue, we appreciate you being with us, and hope that you'll be able to join us next Friday as well to keep us up to date on what's happening at network computing.
Okay, great. Thank you, Kurt.
That was Sue Fogarty, who is chief editor at Network Computing. As she said, the infrastructure piece of the Information Week family. We're glad to have her with us. Now, we're going to turn our attention from networking infrastructure to big data and business analysis. And for that, we have one of our favorite editors, Doug Henschen, who is here at Information Week. Doug, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thank you, Kurt. Good to be here. Happy New Year, everyone.
And a Happy New Year to you. Now, you are here. You recently wrote an article about a survey that we did here at Information Week involving big data and business analysis. Tell us a little bit about that survey.
Well, it's actually it's a survey we've been doing for years. It's what we call a tracking survey, where we ask pretty much the same questions every year. It kind of morphs year to year, bringing in new topics, letting go of tired topics. But you get this consistency of questions, so you can plot trends, see what people thought this year versus what people thought last year. And so it's called our Analytics, BI, and Data Management Survey. And, you know, big data was a part of it, but more broadly, even, you know, more conventional analytics, more conventional BI and data management, data warehouses and such. So it's a good wrap-up. The two themes this year were sort of a trend towards sort of simplifying analytics or providing smart features that help people use otherwise, you know, fairly sophisticated analytics tools. And another was big data and whether, you know, we need new tools to kind of explore the variety and volumes of data that we're encountering. So those were topically in the report. And then this week I kicked off with this, or actually late last week, this 5 analytics, BI, and data management trends for 2015. And I can talk about those if you're interested.
Oh, we're certainly interested in those now, but I have a question based on what you just said. You mentioned people wanting to make analytics easier to use. Is the visualization of the data that's coming out of the analytics something that is continuing to evolve? I know that I've seen a lot of that, say, when I go to SAP's Sapphire conference. Is that one of the areas where simplicity and understanding what's going on is important, or are there other areas where the simplicity and push towards not having to have the humans work quite so hard, where those are coming into play a little bit more strongly?
Data visualization is definitely part of it. One of the hottest vendors in analytics and BI is Tableau Software, and, you know, data visualization is their middle name. You know, a picture is worth 1,000 words, so to speak, and so data visualizations let you see what's going on in the data as opposed to, you know, trying to look at columns and rows. You know, the long trend or the long problem, long-standing problem in BI and analytics is that these tools are perceived as too difficult, too, you know, quirky, for the data high priests or something. And so adoption has been, you know, in the very most successful deployments of these tools, they're being used by something like 25% of people in organizations. That's a success. And so we've seen this trend, and certainly Tableau's success, Qlik Software's success, has led all the standby, you know, incumbent big BI players, you know, Oracle, IBM, SAP, MicroStrategy, and others, to add these data visualization modules and also something called data discovery modules. And that's for data exploration. So even still, penetration is not great. Even tools like Tableau are not necessarily something that people that are used to Excel are necessarily going to take to all that quickly. So there's been a drive to come up with, you know, there's really two approaches I write about in this report. One is to add features like auto-suggestion. So you bring data in, and this tool automatically kind of pops up some data visualizations that it, based on algorithms, feels are the best way to visualize that data. It's sort of, you don't have to know, well, this should be a bar, or this should be a chart, or this should be a scatter plot. It sort of knows, looks at the data, looks at the metadata, and understands what is the best visualization to present that, that form of analysis, that form of correlation, whatever it might be. And so companies like SAS and IBM, with their IBM Watson Analytics introduction last year, have introduced those sort of automation features and suggestion features. TIBCO Spotfire announced something this week along the same lines with their cloud-based Spotfire Cloud auto recommendation, whereas other vendors have focused on, let's make the tool itself far simpler, far more intuitive. And I think you'd put Tableau in that category, you'd put Qlik in that category, and those two companies are looking at coming up with even simpler software. Tableau is working on this project for a tablet app that will, you'll bring a spreadsheet data into it and it'll let you play with the data. And Qlik has come out with an even easier visualization module for its software. So you see these two patterns, you know, adding smarts to make it easier or simplifying even more to make it easier for business users to interact with and understand data.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned the simplification that is pushing things. I know at CES, one of the things that I kept hearing people say was the customer doesn't want to have to think about this. And it seems like that's really where you say things are going in analytics. People don't want to think about how the analysis happens. They just want the analysis to happen. You had mentioned trends. Is that one of the trends? And can you share with us some of the other trends that you see ahead for 2015 in this area?
Well, sure. I mean, I think simplification and wanting to make data analysis easier has been a long-term trend. It's not one of the five I spotted, but I can cite examples where, you know, BI vendors and sort of embedded BI technology and analytics, they're trying to bring that not just to users within the enterprise, but to customers. TrueCar is an example of a big data practitioner I recently talked to. They help customers with buying and buying a car, and they offer all sorts of analyses like the average cost for a car and cars in their area and whether they're getting a good deal. And they present that with you know, data from the dealers in their areas, data from the manufacturers in their areas, and they have to present it in a way that's consumer-friendly. And they've done just that. And they've come up with data visualizations that make things really clear and simple. Am I getting a good deal or am I not? How does this compare to what other people are paying for this model, et cetera? But the five trends identified in my column, which is called Five Analytics BI Data Management Trends for 2015, the first was sort of a waning of BI standardization. For past 8 years or so, companies were kind of weeding out BI tools and trying to standardize on a few tools that they could deploy across the enterprise. So they're dealing with fewer vendors, consolidating their purchasing, getting a better deal from the fewer vendors that remained. But in the study this year, that's breaking down, and it was breaking down quite a bit. Last year, 35% of our respondents said that they have standardized on one or a few tools, and this year only 28%. So, a good 7% drop. And meanwhile, those that said they have many analytics and BI products scattered throughout their organization increased to 21% from 16% the previous year. So solid data showing, and I think reflecting that, times are changing with big data analysis coming to the fore. People are experimenting. They're looking at new tools. They don't necessarily feel that the one or two or three BI tools they've been using for a decade fit all their needs. So that's a sign of experimentation. So that was one trend. Another was cloud-based data warehousing on a big upswing. Amazon Redshift is a good example of that. They've called that one of their most successful new products ever. And we saw IBM introduced DB-DB, a cloud-based database service, and they also acquired Cloudant, a NoSQL database service, in 2014. And Vertica has also announced, HP Vertica has also announced that they'll have cloud-based data warehousing. Real-time technology shows signs of really taking off. That's been a consistent theme in 2014, and it's looking strong for 2015. Hadoop and NoSQL adoption are a theme of ongoing thing of big data platform adoption. And then finally, and a little controversially, data quality concerns. Data from the sort of analytics and BI community, those respondents show that their concerns about it are easing somewhat. Now, I have to qualify that because it's still the number one concern they have, the number one what we call barrier to success. So it's, but this year, 51% put data quality number one versus 59% last year. So that was a big swing. Meanwhile, if you talk to data management pros, they still see it as, they too still see it as their number one, but their concerns aren't easing all that much. So those are the big five we talked about.
Well, it sounds like a lot to keep up with, a lot that's going to keep us busy for the coming year. And Doug, we're looking forward to you keeping us abreast of all that's going on in the world of big data, data analysis, business intelligence, all those good things. Now, before you go, can you tell everyone where they can keep up with you and if there's anything in specific they should be looking forward to from you in the coming week?
Sure. Well, I'm informationweek.com. I see my face there every day. And next week I have a cloud-based analytics sort of image gallery in the works, sharing, you know, the analytics and BI tools that you can, you know, use on demand, software as a service style. And I also have some tech priorities for 2015, a number of which I picked up at this week's National Retail Federation Big Show in New York. So a lot of CIOs were there, a lot of good ideas shared. That should be up early next week.
Outstanding. Well, Doug, we appreciate you being with us, and we will look forward to having you on many times in the coming year.
All right. Thanks, Kurt.
That was Doug Hinchin of Information Week talking with us about big data, data analysis, business intelligence, the sorts of things he covers so very well here at Information Week. Just a reminder, this is Information Week Live. Information Week, connecting the business technology community. Here, live every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Also available for streaming at Information Week in archive format on Blog Talk Radio. And soon, we hope, on iTunes. We hope you will follow us in any and or all of those forms. Well, next, we're going to turn our gaze from business intelligence to security. And to do that, we have with us Sarah Peters, who is a senior editor at another of our sibling sites, Dark Reading. Sarah, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thank you, Kurt. Happy to be here.
And a happy new year to you.
Likewise.
Well, I know that you spend all of your time looking at security issues. So my first question of 2015 is there anything going on in security that doesn't involve Sony?
Yes, I would say there are. And there are some things that are that say that they're not related to Sony, but are secretly inspired by Sony. So I can start with either. It's up to you.
Ooh, now tell us about this secret Sony inspiration. That sounds like the plot to a movie whose script might have been taken from their servers.
Well, what I mean by that is simply security is now on the minds of people because of the big Sony debacle. So it seems like there may be more open-minded leaders in business who are now making security a priority, and same goes for the government, that they are thinking more about how to solve this giant problem. So even whether or not they are actively going against that kind of attack, the high profile mess is definitely making them think about it more.
Interesting. Now, from what you're seeing, is all of this involving only corporate sites, or are people turning this kind of attention to government sites as well?
That's a good question. I think that this kind of hugely destructive attack, which is really what the Sony hack was, it wasn't a financially motivated thing. It was just about doing as much damage as possible. I think that government sites are always going to be target of that kind of thing by nation states that consider the U.S. to be an enemy of the state, basically. We haven't heard about anything significant, any kind of attacks like that. The biggest thing this past week was simply that the U.S. Central Command had their Twitter account hijacked by a group that's kind of a cyber militia for the Muslim extremists in the Middle East there. It's called Cyber Caliphate. And so not a real big deal. It's just your Twitter account, and they were able to remove access to that feed from the attackers. So that's a reputational damage type of thing, but that's really as far as it goes. Those kinds of things do keep cropping up, more of what we call cyber vandalism. But as problems go, that's a pretty small one to have.
You know, one of our folks over in the live discussion, Dave Wagner, who will be joining us on the air here in a few minutes, points out that he's a little annoyed by the fact that U.S. Central Command even has a Twitter account. I know that was one of the things that surprised me a bit. It's right up there with, the NSA Twitter account, just something that seems a little contradictory on the face of it.
That's an interesting thought, but I wonder if although the account would be used for communicating to the general public, that I think that all government agencies right now are thinking they need to be a little bit more transparent than they once upon a time had to be. They have messages to manage, just like every organization and government agency does. I do imagine that it is also a way for them to gather some intelligence, because there are a lot of hacking groups that use Twitter extensively to, hacktivists saying, kind of taking over Twitter accounts or issuing threats. They use Twitter a lot to stir up trouble. So it would be valuable for government agencies, military agencies to keep tabs on that. Also, it would be useful when you're trying to gain intelligence that could be of assistance in military maneuvers. You can, when you aggregate it, get some ideas of how people are moving and what conflicts are happening in a place at a certain time. And that, when you think about it from that perspective, it's not all that surprising that they would have some presence on Twitter, as long as they're not out there tweeting all kinds of secrets about U.S. military maneuvers. I don't think it's the worst thing in the world. The problem with this one was that the account was registered to a staff member's personal email account. That raises more problems, but overall, I don't think it's something to completely freak out about.
Yeah, I suppose that the sort of thing that says, you know, see the SEALs come ashore at this location would probably not be what we'd want to see coming out of CENTCOM. You know, we're coming sort of to the end of our time together for this week, but I'm curious. I do want to ask one more question, and I'm sorry it's going to be about Sony again, but the people that you talk to in the industry, because the Sony attack was, as you say, purely malicious, there wasn't greed there, it was just sort of vindictive. With the scale of it, is this seen as any sort of game changer, or is it sort of run-of-the-mill stuff that differs only because of the scale and hence the visibility of what was going on?
I think it's the latter. It's not like it's starting a new trend. From what the experts that I've spoken to tell me, they think that this is, by the scale of it, it's kind of an anomaly. It shows what is possible. And for that reason, it's raising eyebrows, because nobody's really taken it this far before. But as far as, is this going to be happening every other month, like, for example, the retail hacks, the point-of-sale hacks that we've seen over the year, I don't think it's going to be that kind of thing. We're not going to see this happen to, MGM next or whatever. It's not going to be of that nature because, like you say, it's a very – destructive attack is a very personal thing. It's either going to be done by a hacktivist, a nation state, a malicious insider. Those parties aren't just going to go after anybody. They're going to have a particular, very focused target in mind. And for that reason, if no others, I don't think this is something that's starting a new trend.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing you follow any real trends that come up in 2015. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on at Dark Reading in the coming week? What should we be looking for from you and others there at Dark Reading? And how can we keep up with you as you post new stuff?
Well, I would first suggest that you go have a read of a story that Kelly Jackson Higgins wrote this week. It was about the President Obama calling for a new national breach notification policy that would require organizations to report within 30 days of discovery that they'd had a data breach. So that's getting a lot of attention. I would say go read that. Next week, we are going to have a radio show on Wednesday at 1 p.m. that is going to be revisiting, guess what, the Sony attack. It's going to be more of a discussion about what lessons were learned from it. We'll have George Kurtz from CrowdStrike and Neil Mueller from Shape Security with us that day. As for me, you can follow me on Twitter at Sarah Peters, S-A-R-A, no H, Peters, and that's about it.
Well, outstanding. Sarah, thank you so much for being with us today, and we will look forward to having you again maybe next week to tell us what's going on in the world of security.
It would be my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
That was Sarah Peters, senior editor at Dark Reading, keeping us up to date on all that's going on in the world of InfoSec, computer security. Please check out security and everything that's going on over at darkreading.com. Well, you know, when a lot of people talk about security, they tend to think about what's going on in the world of Microsoft. And on the desktop, that's Windows. To talk with us about what's happening in the world of Windows this week, we have a new contributor to Information Week Live, Kelly Sheridan. Kelly, welcome to Information Week Live.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Kelly, now this week you wrote a number of pieces, but I know one of them was about a milestone in a major operating system. It looks like we're seeing the beginning of the end of Windows 7. What's going on there?
Right. So, unfortunately, this week we learned that Microsoft will be pulling the plug on Main Street support for Windows 7. But people using it right now don't need to panic just yet, because it's transitioning from a period of mainstream support into extended support. So while people won't have access to free incident support or warranty claims or design changes, they will still be receiving security fixes when certain bugs pop up. So the OS will be secure through, I believe, January 14th, 2020, when it's expected that Windows will shut down the system for good.
So we have a good 5 years for people to make plans to move off of Windows 7. Given what we know about the number of people who are still using Windows XP, do you think 5 years is really enough time?
You know, that's a great question. I think it depends on what Microsoft brings us in the coming months. We're expecting more details on the consumer version of Windows 10 in an event next week, so fingers crossed they make some positive changes there. Windows 8 and Windows 8.1 were not well received, so I'm kind of hoping that we see some major changes in the new OS that will push people to switch. Right now, Windows 7 holds more than 50% of the global operating system market share, so I think it'll have to be a tough sell to get everyone to move to the new system.
You mentioned that Windows 8 and even 8.1, which was supposed to be a major improvement, haven't been as well received as Microsoft perhaps would have liked. Do you have any ideas that have come your way? Have you seen anything that gives you any confidence that Windows 10 is going to be able to break out above what Windows 8 has done? What kind of secrets can you share with us so far?
Well, unfortunately, Microsoft has been stingy with the updates on Windows 10, but we're hoping to see more improvements to the mobile OS and more consistency with PCs, tablets, and mobile phones, just a general improvement to the operating system that'll it'll show more consistency across all devices. I don't have too much on that front right now, but hoping to see more details during Wednesday's event.
When you look at what little has come out about Windows 10, do you get any sense, or do you think, based on what you know of Microsoft's direction, that there could be any closer ties to the cloud world in what's going on with Windows 10? I know that that's a huge focus for Microsoft's current CEO. Do you think that there has been enough time for that to be reflected in Windows 10?
A bit. One of the things that's leaked about Windows 10 is the addition of new details to a new browser from Microsoft. Right now that's codenamed Spartan. I'm not sure if they're going to change that or not. But it's expected that they're going to have a new kind of a service for taking notes. So so that users of Windows 10 will be able to take notes of the stylus on their web pages and share them via the OneDrive cloud storage and access them from any browser. And it's also expected that the Spartan browser will be released as a Windows Store app so that the company can provide updates faster and more easily.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that sharing notes, because it seems like one of the big trends that we're seeing kind of all over the place, not just in Microsoft, is the push to collaboration. You know, working with other people being something that is receiving more and more attention. Is that something that you have sort of heard rumblings about? Does that seem to be something that Microsoft is talking about as they come out with new products these days?
Well, Microsoft recently decided to partner with PayPal to make some moves in the mobile payment space. This week it announced that it would be partnering with PayPal to it's targeting small businesses to help improve mobility and customer engagement, because businesses a lot of the time will use laptops for handling inventory and supply and customer information, but then separately they'll use tablets so that they can carry a machine around the store so they can interact with customers while they work. So the idea here is that businesses will use the Surface Pro 3 or a similar 2-in-1 hybrid device so that they can keep track of all their orders and their stock but still carry the machine around to help customers. So Microsoft and PayPal are collaborating, and PayPal's coming out with a new card reader, and they're partnering to launch a Windows 8.1 app so that businesses that use Windows can use the card reader and the app to take orders and process payments from anywhere in the business.
Now, does it seem like with this that Microsoft and PayPal are trying hard to compete directly with, say, Square and Intuit with their little card readers that you see popping up everywhere?
I would say yes. This seems very similar. I'm not sure how the card reader will look, how it will attach to the device, but it's a similar concept. I heard that Square is coming out with they're going to be able to accept EMV payments. The technology that embeds a little chip into the credit card or debit card or what have you. And it's looking like PayPal is going to launch a similar service later this year. So I would say yes, they're trying to be competitive.
You know, it is interesting. I like to go to art shows and I love farmers markets, and it's fascinating the extent to which these little card readers have changed the world of transactions at both of those sorts of things. It's rare to find someone, you know, with a bushel basket of rutabagas somewhere that doesn't take credit card payment now because of one of these. And the same is true for artists. So it's going to be interesting to see if the weight of Microsoft and PayPal can make a huge difference in the further penetration of these devices. And it sounds like it's going to be something that's interesting to talk about in articles going forward.
Absolutely, I agree. I'm looking forward to kind of staying on top of it and seeing where this goes.
Well, now, Kelly, tell us a couple of things. First of all, what do you have planned for the coming week? And how can we keep up with what you're doing? How can we follow all of your writing and your thoughts?
Sure. Well, in particular, next Wednesday, I'm looking forward to Microsoft's big event. On January 21st, they'll be launching a bunch of new details on Windows 10 for consumers. We're expecting more details on mobile specifically and, like I said, more details on their browser. So I'll be staying on top of that. In the coming days, I believe on Monday or Tuesday, you'll be able to see kind of a preview of what I think we're going to be seeing during that show. And then the day of the show and in the days following, I'll be staying on top of what we saw, what this means for the future of the company, and different ideas like that. And you can find all of those posts on Information Week.
Outstanding. Well, Kelly, thank you so much for being with us on this episode of this Information Week. We will look forward to talking with you about Microsoft and other things in weeks to come.
Thanks for having me.
That was Kelly Sheridan, an associate editor here at Information Week. We're pleased to have her making her first contributions to Information Week Live. Now, one more reminder, this is brought to you by Information Week, connecting the business technology community, your home for all kinds of commentary, insight, and information about the things that matter for the people who make IT happen in the business world. Well, speaking of things that matter, it is time now to talk with Dave Wagner, who is, as always, giving us some thought-provoking information in the Geek End. Dave, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thanks, Kurt. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm just peachy, and it sounds like you have been finding all sorts of interesting things to occupy your mind. Now, Elon Musk is the gift that keeps on giving for journalists, but you found some things that I really didn't know about. What did you find to write about this week in the Geek End?
Well, I wrote about a brand new sport that I hope he is going to found, even if he doesn't do it on purpose. I think he's going to found it accidentally, and I'm calling it Hyperloop Pod Racing.
Now, Hyperloop Pod Racing sounds like the sort of thing that that we saw in Star Wars Episode One. Is that what you have in mind?
Well, a little bit, much less in quantity of whiny kids, fewer huts trying to fix the races, but similar. For those who may be unaware, the Hyperloop is something that Musk has been putting out there for a couple of years now. The idea is that if you take a tube and you reduce the air pressure inside of that tube, and then you put a vehicle inside, in this case his mind is around a magnetically induced vehicle, probably a maglev train, something like that, and you put it inside there, it's going to go much, 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 much faster because of the lack of air resistance. And he believes that we can go from San Francisco to Los Angeles in about 30 minutes, maybe even less. That's about 700 miles an hour. So to test this theory, which many engineers say is plausible, he is going to build a test track in Texas that's about 5 miles long, probably circular in nature. So I'm really excited about this because when I hear 5 mile track, 700 miles an hour, I think, oh, geez, now we need a race.
It sounds to me like the sort of thing that that really should have NASCAR interested.
I would think that NASCAR would be interested, except potentially because it's not a, because something in a Hyperloop is usually not individually motorized. Usually the motors are on the outside of the tube, linear induction motors. NASCAR may not be necessarily interested, but I think a lot of companies should be. NASCAR is struggling right now, and many race companies are struggling right now because engine builders, tire builders, people like that feel like they may have gotten as much out of racing as they probably can for the price they're paying to do it. What I like about the Hyperloop is here's another place excuse me, where people can start investing money in a new technology, and if a race could be made from it, it might pay for some of that technology through television rights.
You know, that does sound awfully interesting, and it sounds like it could get around one of the limitations. I know on a flight a year or so ago, I was seated next to the crew chief for one of the top fuel drag racing teams. And he was saying that they had done a couple of things. One is shorten the track. People who don't follow drag racing might not know that it's no longer a quarter mile in NHRA. And the other is put fuel cutoff in the engines to limit the top speeds for insurance purposes. Now, a top fuel dragster, before they were doing this, they were hitting somewhere in the 320s, 320 plus miles an hour in a quarter mile, and they had a couple of spectacular and notable accidents, and apparently the insurance companies decided that this was just too much liability for them to deal with. But in a closed environment like a Hyperloop, it sounds like some of those insurance concerns could be allayed. What do you think about that?
Well, to be honest, I think we still have a lot to learn about what a crash at 700 miles an hour in a Hyperloop looks like, because I think we're still settling on the final technology. But I do know that one place those insurance concerns matter is in travel. 700 miles an hour isn't that much faster than a jet airplane can fly. So one wonders, why do we need to have a train to do that when we have airplanes to do it? My first thought is that when there's a problem at 37,000 feet, gravity takes over and things get messy. If there's a problem on the ground in a Hyperloop, my general belief is if we use the right technology, what will happen is actually the limited amount of air resistance that is still there combined with the lack of the engine working, the thing is just going to slow down. It's just going to eventually come to a stop, probably a sparky stop, probably a scrapey stop, but it's got nothing to hit because each tube is going to be individualized. There's not going to be one coming the other direction that's going to slam into you. So whether from a racing point of view it's easy, I'm not sure, but I think it has some real advantages from a travel safety point of view.
Well, I like the travel safety aspect. I'll admit that. From the racing standpoint, growing up in NASCAR country, it seems to me that if you can't trade paint, you give up a lot. But, hey, that's just me.
There's a sad reality to that in racing people kind of like it partially because they know people are putting their life on the line.
True enough, and that does happen. Well, you know, this is an awfully thought-provoking article, as you always bring us on Fridays with the Geek End. But Dave, I know that the Geek End isn't all you're doing here at Information Week. Tell us, what kind of articles are you working on for the coming week?
Well, I'm going to be working a lot in our IT Life section. If you're not following the IT Life section, you really need to. It's going to have a lot of great stuff about your career and what you do in and out of your job. And in IT Life, expect to see from me very soon a story on how millennials can talk to old people. I feel like for a long time we've been writing all these articles talking about, oh, millennials are terrible, millennials do this, millennials do that, this is how you manage them. Well, you know what? Millennials need to learn how to talk to us old geezers, too. So that's what I'm working on. I'm also working on some interesting things about office politics and companies training customers to be more polite.
Sounds like a lot to keep up with and a lot to look forward to on the electronic pages of Information Week. And when you're not on Information Week, tell us, how can we follow you? Do you do any of the Twitter stuff, Instagram, Facebook, Pinterest, any of those social networks that, speaking of millennials, they seem to be so very, very fond of?
Yeah, follow me on Twitter at GeekAndDave, all one word, and expect an Instagram page from me soon. I've kind of avoided that, probably because I'm an old geezer, but we have some good ideas coming for what we're going to do with that soon. So hopefully by the time you talk to me next, I'll have an Instagram account and some interesting stuff on it.
Outstanding. Well, we appreciate it, and we will look forward to talking with you next Friday when we find out what you found to tell us in the next Geekend. Dave, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Kurt. Happy Geekend, everybody.
That was Dave Wagner here at Information Week. Always happy to talk with us about the Geekend and other thought-provoking things. Well, we're coming towards the end of our time here for this episode of Information Week Live. Do want to let everyone know that I'm also writing here at Information Week. I've been doing some pieces based on my trip out to the Consumer Electronics Show, CES, last week. Today, have a piece on drones and would love to see what you have to think and say about drones in the enterprise. More great things coming up. And next week, I will be writing about educational technology. There's a big educational technology conference happening in Orlando, Florida, FETC. I will be there talking to companies and talking to educators about what's going on with technology in education and how that information can be useful for businesses and the enterprise. If you want to keep up with me, feel free to do so. I'm on Twitter at KG4GWA, on Instagram at Kurt Franklin, and would love to have you follow me on both those places. Now, in addition, please plan to join us every Friday at this time, that's 3 p.m. Eastern, for a live version of Information Week Live. Of course, you can always find us online in archive versions here at Information Week on Blog Talk Radio and very soon on iTunes. Speaking of iTunes, that's one of the places you can find Interop Radio. Now, Interop Radio happens live every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Look for us on Blog Talk Radio and on iTunes. We hope you will join us for both of these shows. Well, for everyone here at Information Week Live, I'm your host, Kurt Franklin, saying thanks so much for being with us. Hey, we'll see you next week.